Hello, everybody. This is Georgianne Hughes, and this is The Bite Show. And we're blessed to have with us David Seeloff. He is the Director of Associates for Scriptural Knowledge, and he does carry on the work of Dr. Ernest L. Martin. You can visit the website at this address, askelm.com. If you have comments, please email David Seeloff at this address, david@askelm.com. And we are beginning part two of Idolatry and the Sons of God. Very interesting topic. Hi, David.
Hi, Georgianne. It's good to be back.
Ah, good to have you back. And this is a really interesting topic.
Yeah. What we were discussing last time is in regard to a series of articles on idolatry, one that Dr. Martin had done, and then I did part two and part three on the sons of God and how they relate to idolatry. And last time we covered regarding the biblical terms for God, regarding the plurals in the singular usage for El and Eloah were singulars, and then the plural forms, which are Elim and Elohim. And, of course, Yahweh is always singular, and Yahweh refers to God the Father. Elohim is a collective noun which is usually plural and to be considered plural, and yet it's often used as a singular, with a singular verb, and particularly when it has a definite article in front of it, it always refers to the Creator God, Yahweh.
Yeah.
But there were other gods in the universe, in the creation, that God has created, and some of them were angels, and you get that by comparing Psalm 8:5 and Hebrews 2:7, where it proves that angels are Elohim and are gods. And likewise, Yahweh is the personal name of God, and yet he is designated as an El of the Elohim, but he is the King of Kings, he is the Lord of Lords, and he is the God of Gods. He is the El of Elohim. He is, and in comparison to him, there are no other gods in comparison to him, but there are other Elohim.
Yeah.
So it's a little bit detailed, and it's a little bit involved, but it is clear and distinguishable. In Psalm 95, verse 3, it says, "For a great El is Yahweh, and a great King above all Elohim." Now, some have recognized that this seems very similar to some ancient texts like Ugaritic, and which were north of Israel, in what we would call Turkey today. And in ancient times, before the divided kingdom. Actually, I think they were during the divided kingdom, and, of course, before King David and Solomon, and then the kingdoms were divided into Israel and Judah. And this is controversial, that the chronologies should be changed according to the biblical model. But, you know, the idea is these Ugaritic texts use these very similar terms, that there is El, who, they don't use the term Yahweh, but there is an El, a God, who is above the other gods. And they are, he is the El, and they are Elohim. And they got this from Israel. Because the chronologies are mixed up, everyone thinks that they gave this to Israel. Well, that's not the case. They got it from Israel, because if you adjust the chronologies according to the biblical model, then everything dovetails perfectly, and the biblical model is the standard against which everything else should be compared. In Deuteronomy 10:17, it says, and inserting the term Yahweh for Lord and Elohim for God, it says, according to the Hebrew, "For Yahweh your Elohim, He is the Elohi of Elohim and the Lord, or Adonai, Lord of Lords. The El, the great and masterful and the feared one. And Joshua later says the same thing. And we covered some of this material last time. Israel could acknowledge other gods, but they were not in any way allowed or permitted or and were strongly discouraged from worshiping other gods. They could understand that other gods existed, but they were not they were not to worship them. In Exodus chapter 23, verses 32 and 33, it says, quote, "You shall make no covenant with them," the other nations, "nor with their Elohim." Now, this tells me plainly that there's a distinction between the nations around Israel and their Elohim.
I have a question.
Yeah.
When they use the word nations there, can we understand that as you are not to make covenant with other ethnic groups?
No, Israel was not supposed to make covenant with other ethnic groups at that time.
Yeah.
Or because they would get ensnared with treaties and trade to a certain extent. Now, it was allowed to make a covenant with other nations if God gave them permission. That was one condition. And the other condition was if Israel was on top.
Yeah.
There were several kinds of treaties in ancient times. There was a suzerain vassal treaty, in which one party was dominant over the other, the vassal. The suzerain was dominant over the vassal. If the pagan nation, say the Canaanites, were dominant over Israel, Israel was not allowed to make a covenant with them. If Israel was dominant, then Israel could make covenants with them if they got God's permission. Likewise. And this is what the situation was with a lot of nations during the time of Solomon. Solomon made trade treaties all over the world, but Israel was on top. Israel was the dominant partner in these trade agreements and these covenants.
Okay.
Now, also, Israel could not make covenants that were between equals. For example, Syria making a covenant with the northern kingdom of Israel. That was not allowed unless God, through the prophets, gave them specific permission to do so. And several times he did. He never gave them permission to make a covenant with Egypt, but frequently he allowed them to make covenants with, during the time of Tyre, the city of Tyre. He allowed them to make covenants with Hiram, the king of Tyre, when the temple was built. Solomon was able to make a partnership, a treaty amongst equals, where Hiram would provide cedar and timber from north of Israel, and workmen to come in, trades craftsmen and that sort of thing, to build the temple. And Solomon, in turn, gave them some cities to rule over. And this was just totally proper. But Israel was not to make a covenant, as it back to Exodus 23. You shall not make a covenant with them, nor your Elohim, and they shall not dwell in your land. See, if you make a covenant with them, then you have to allow them into your land. And you shall not dwell, they shall not dwell in your land, lest they make you sin against me, against Yahweh. For if you serve their Elohim, it shall surely be a snare unto you. So that this acknowledges that those other Elohim existed, and that you could even make a covenant with those Elohim. Now, we're not talking about the idols. We're talking about the creatures, the beings that were represented by the stone idols of wood and stone.
Yeah.
They were real beings. And this text of Exodus chapter 23, verses 32 to 33, demonstrates that it was possible for Israel, both the nation collectively and for individuals, to covenant with or to form an agreement with the gods, the Elohim of the Canaanites. Just as it was possible for Israel to make covenants with the Canaanites and other nations, just as Israel formed a covenant with Yahweh. Yahweh made a covenant with Israel in Exodus chapter 19. Now, you've got the story of Ruth, but the Israelites went to Moab, and there Ruth met her Israelite husband and married him. However, that was permissible. If the Israelites go somewhere else, it was permissible for them to marry a Moabitess woman. Probably not recommended, but there was no sin against it. But they could not bring a Moabitess woman to live in Israel, for the purpose of getting married, because that would be making a marriage covenant.
Yes.
So it is precise and it's involved, but it all makes perfectly good sense. The problem is that if they made covenants, either as individuals or nations, they would end up worshiping those gods with idolatrous acts, and most all foreign Elohim, foreign gods, worship of them involved sexual activities, usually groups or with the priests or the priestesses.
Yeah.
And this, of course, was another aspect that was totally forbidden, along with other unfortunate and disgusting things such as child sacrifice, which was practiced by most of the pagan religions surrounding Israel, including Egypt.
Now, David, did the pagans indulge in sex with children?
Yes.
Oh, dear.
And as a matter of fact, there is no law. As a matter of fact, Israel allowed slavery, and the master had full sexual rights over the slaves.
Even the children?
Well, I don't know, probably. There's no prohibition against it in Scripture. Now, remember, as soon as a female, she was eligible for marriage as soon as she had her first period.
Yes.
Conditions and situations were different in those days.
That's true.
A lot of criticism is made against Muhammad for this. However, in that culture and in that society, and they did not follow the biblical model. This is the problem with hypersexualizing children today, both through the media and everything.
Right.
And I'm telling you, my research into ritual abuse indicates, and I'm not a doctor or a sociologist or anything, but the body responds to stimuli at a very, very early age. The pedophile Kinsey discovered this. Actually, he was just verifying what he already knew in the studies that he did. He did studies with children. Well, the only way in which you can find out about the sex life of children is to expose them to some very unfortunate and disgusting things.
Yeah, that's right.
And that's what he did.
Yes.
And he was not a hero.
No,
he was a very evil man.
Yes, he was.
In my view. And that's my opinion.
Mine also.
Yeah. And, it's a fascinating story that is now finally starting to come out in the last couple of decades about Kinsey and the ugly things that he did. But, and this has been known for a long time, the reason that children are having periods and children are having children at earlier and earlier ages is because they are being sexualized at earlier and earlier ages.
Right.
And this is what another thing that the pagans did themselves. If you do this, this is one of the reasons that paganism is so abhorrent. It damages the individual, not just the corporate nation and the tribe and the people and the larger family. So people forget about these things, that it was different. But, Israel could make covenants with the Canaanite peoples, but it was forbidden. it was possible for them to make covenants with the gods, and this is exactly what the northern kingdom of Israel, after Solomon, the two kingdoms spread apart, Judah and Israel, this is exactly what got the northern kingdom in trouble. They allowed other gods to come in. They made covenants individually and with other nations, and they worshiped the false gods. Now, they even in the northern kingdom of Israel, it's important to understand, they always continued to worship Yahweh, but they worshiped the other gods also. And eventually this polluted Judah also, the southern kingdom. And this is what the prophets were constantly railing against. They didn't ever deny that these other gods existed. It's just that, A, these other gods were like nothing, and they shouldn't be worshipped, and B, if you worship them, God's going to punish the nations. And they were indeed ensnared by these other gods and the pagan peoples. And this resulted in the nation and the people of Israel of receiving God's punishment and eventual exile exactly as he predicted in Deuteronomy and in, you know, the other books of the Torah. It's so sad. But, and in a way, God predicted this. So who were these gods of the nations that these people were praying? Originally in Hebrew, their formal name of the major gods of the gods of the nations were called, in Hebrew, Benai HaElohim, the sons of the Elohim. The phrase the Elohim is a reference to Yahweh. And they're referred to by that name in Hebrew in Genesis 6:4, in Job 1, chapter 1, verse 6, and in Job chapter 2, verse 1. Now, after the sons of God were judged by Yahweh, angels then, evil angels, took up the role of ruling these nations as gods. But they did it in a manner that was different than the sons of God. This is where in history you see the distinction between what's called the elder gods and the younger gods. The elder gods, in my opinion, were these gods of the nations, the Benai HaElohim, the sons of God.
Yeah.
Later on, the angels that ran, they ran and operated and were the quote, small g gods behind the oracles, the Oracle of Delphi and the Oracle at Ephesus and this sort of thing. Remember when Paul went to Ephesus, he got into trouble because he stopped the possessed python spirit from possessing the oracle that was in Ephesus. And they, you know, he was hurting business. So they tried to kill him.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what was going on here. Christ had, of course, put down these entities, and because they encountered Paul and messed with him, he stopped their practice immediately. And Ephesus was a major source of idolatry, both commercial and religious. And Paul put a crimp in their business, because they interfered with him first. He would have left them alone, but they messed with him. So, you know, that's how it goes. So, these angels are also called Elohim, as we mentioned earlier.
Right.
And as this was the distinction between angels as gods and the sons of gods as gods, was first pointed out by Dr. Ernest Martin, who noted that Hebrews chapter 1, according to Hebrews chapter 1, it says specifically that angels cannot be sons of Elohim, but they are Elohim. So that you've got to you must distinguish between the sons of God and the angels, both classes of which are Elohim, are gods, lower G.
You're right.
Now, all the power that they have, both as angels and the sons of God, are derived and given and granted to them from God the Father through his delegation and allowance. why does he let the evil gods, you know, have any power?
Yeah.
Well, he's chosen to do that as an so that examples can be made both of them and to us. Both them, meaning the sons of God and the angels, they're made examples of what not to do when you have power, but also as examples to us as to what happens when you follow the false god,
right.
A false god.
Right.
So these gods were, the sons of God in particular, were Elohim with vast powers and authority, far beyond angelic beings. Now, the sons of God, or the Benacha Elohim, are introduced in Genesis 6, verses 1 to 4. And in the printed version of this article, Idolatry and the Sons of God, I have set this out in outline form for clarity, because these verses are just literally packed with meaning if you read them and understand them carefully. Now, I'm going to read Genesis 6, 1 to 4 from the Jewish Publication Society version of the 1917. Quote, "And it came to pass, when men began to multiply on the face of the earth," and this would be Adam, "when men," Adam, "began to multiply on the face of the earth, and daughters were born unto them, that the sons of Elohim saw the daughters of men," or the daughters of Adam, "that they were fair, and they took them wives, whomsoever they chose." Now note that there's a distinction between the sons of Elohim and the daughters of Adam. And second, they took them as wives. They didn't rape them. They didn't steal them away like Job, but Zeus took, a female and, you know, had his way with her and would, in the form of a goose or whatever. But these were wives. This is the normal Hebrew term for wives. So that these women married these entities, these sons of Elohim. There's nothing apparently wrong here. However, the result turned out to be a great evil. Verse 3, "And Yahweh said, My spirit shall not abide in man," or Adam, "forever, for that he also is flesh. Therefore shall his days be 120 years." This verse 3 apparently means that because of the evil that's going to be described in verse later on, that this Adam's, it'll be 120 more years that will be put as a limit to man's longevity at this point. Now, this might mean 120 years till the flood, too. But, in other words, God has had enough, and he's going to limit the days of man, or perhaps Adam specifically, to 120 years more. Then in verse 4, it says, "The giants," that's the translation, the Hebrew term is Nephilim, "the giants were in the earth in those days, and also after that, when the sons of Elohim came in unto the daughters of men, and they bore children to them," and these were the Nephilim, "the same were the mighty men that were of old, the men of renown." And this would be men like, Nimrod and other great men of antiquity. Hercules would be of a similar type, but
now,
he was post-flood.
Also, these are hybrids.
Yes.
Yes. Okay.
Hybrid sons of God, whatever they were able to successfully breed. Now, it says later on that, we'll actually come to that later on.
Okay.
But later on, this outbreak, this encounter between the sons of Elohim and the daughters of men took place both before the flood and after the flood. And Goliath, it specifically says that Goliath was one of these offspring. and that he was actually several generations down the road, so that the offspring were able to breed successfully with other women.
Yeah.
And I would imagine that the giant characteristics were diminished, not in Goliath's case. And Goliath had a brother, remember, as
yes.
it's stated in Scripture. And this group of giants had associated with the Philistines at the time of David. And shortly after the time of David, most of them were killed off, unless they scattered somewhere all over the world. But it appears that in Israel, they had a regular area, territory, that was, you might say, called the land of the giants.
Well, you know, in Ginsberg's Legends of the Jews, it says that a lot of them fled to Gaza and beyond.
Right.
Yeah.
And, of course, they were pagans, just like the Canaanites and the Philistines, so the Philistines were happy to have them come in because they were mighty warriors. You know, when you've got somebody 8, 9, 10 feet tall, they can wield a bigger sword and a spear, just like Goliath was able to do so.
Now, another question. In studying this and David and the lineage, there somehow David in some way is related to Goliath.
That I don't know. I understand we had discussed that before, and it's in Ginsberg somehow. I mean, after all, David's blood was not pure. Ruth, his grandmother, was a Moabitess who participated. If she grew up in that culture, she participated, and then you've got, you know, Rahab the harlot from Jericho. All of these women, and it's not just women, but all of these descendants of David, the female descendants of David, they all had, and Bathsheba, she married a Hittite.
Yeah.
And before, apparently, Uriah the Hittite had, and she was an adulteress.
Yeah.
Uriah the Hittite had come from a pagan society. Pagan religion involved having sex in temples with people other than your wife and husband. And sometimes it was the community would get together for festivals and everyone would have sex with everyone else. So that the whole purpose was to inbreed, and the purpose of the gods was to diminish or to delay or perhaps even prevent the Messiah, the clear line of the Messiah, from developing.
Right.
That's why they kept trying to destroy the line of David, but you know, God didn't allow that. He didn't make any difference. He allowed Rahab the harlot to come into the line of David and allowed Ruth the Moabitess to be his grandmother. Let's put it this way. Ruth slept around before she married her Israelite husband. Okay.
Yeah.
So did, of course, the prostitute. And it's very likely that Rahab the harlot was a temple prostitute, because most prostitution was temple prostitution in those days.
Now, David,
in pagan societies.
Yeah. Also, wasn't there something about if a man had a lot of debts that he couldn't pay, he could pay them by taking his daughter to the temple and putting her into temple prostitution?
In pagan societies,
yeah.
And that was, you know, there were occasions in which some of the southern kingdom of Judah kings allowed temple prostitutes to take place in the temple.
Oh, dear.
Needless to say, God was not pleased. Now, we're talking both male and female temple prostitutes.
Yeah.
And, you know, this was not a good thing. In the passage of Genesis 6:4 that we just mentioned, the sons of God are not identified by Moses as to who they were, where they came from. In other words, Moses did not elaborate on, nor did he elaborate on why they did their activities. Moses merely reports what they did and that the result was negative, as it goes on in Genesis. And this, the evil that these children of the sons of God and the daughters of men promulgated, not just them, but it went out to all humanity, that they all became so great and evil that God felt it necessary to bring on the flood. Now, they're not mentioned anywhere else in Genesis, but the audience that Moses was writing to, he wrote this down, and speaking to, they knew exactly who the sons of God were. And, the Israelites knew who the sons of God were from the book of Job, which was written and put down sometime before Moses compiled the book of Genesis. Moses may have been the one to put pen to paper in Genesis, and certainly from Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. But he compiled Genesis from older documents, and he also had access to the book of Job. Now, in the book of Job, the sons of God, the Bnei HaElohim, are identified as heavenly beings. First of all, the sons of God have access to God's throne in heaven. And this is told in Job chapter 1 and verse 6, which is nearly identical to Job chapter 2 and verse 1. Quote, "Now it fell upon a day that the sons of Elohim came to present themselves before Yahweh, and Satan also came among them." And it's almost identical in Job chapter 2 and verse 1.
It's interesting also to note that Satan is differentiated.
Right.
He is something separate from the sons of God.
Now, some people feel that this means that Satan was a son of God. I don't think so.
No.
I do think that this, like you say, exactly, it differentiates him from them. It says he came among them.
Yes.
Now, this also indicates a very high status on his part, mm-hmm, as the prosecuting attorney, you might say, the accuser, which was what he did in the book of Job.
Right.
They all came before God's throne in heaven, and obviously this is a vision, and presented themselves to Yahweh. This information was probably given to Job sometime after the whole incident took place, so that he could write it down. Now, they did this again on a different day in Job chapter 2 and verse 1. Now, physical human beings do not go before the throne of God except in vision. Isaiah went to a council. This is called the divine council in Job chapter 1 and Job chapter 2 and in Isaiah and Ezekiel, where for human beings to view this is always done in vision. Human beings do not go in front of the throne of God except in vision. When Paul had his vision, he went to see the heavenly, remember it says he didn't even know if he did this in the body or not. It was so real. Likewise, the Apostle John, in the entire book of Revelation, he had a vision given to him of what took place or would take place in the future in heaven. So, physical human beings do not go before the throne of God except in vision, but these sons of God are Elohim, divine beings, shown presenting themselves in front of God himself. Paul calls, now, as we said, Satan is distinguished from the sons of Elohim. He came also among them, but Satan is definitely of the more general class called Elohim, because Paul calls Satan the god of this age, god of this world, or this age, or aeon, in 2 Corinthians chapter 4 and verse 4. But he is nowhere identified as one of the specific class of the sons of Elohim. Now, how can we know that because Satan came also among them, as it says in Job, that this does not indicate that he is one of the sons of God? Well, I think the answer is fairly simple. What is the image and likeness of Satan? It is as a serpent, a Nakash, as he's identified in Genesis chapter 3, verses 1 and 2, and verse 4, and verse 13. Satan is identified clearly as the dragon in Revelation. And a dragon definitely has a reptilian image and likeness, which is totally different from the image of God, which is, as many angels are identified, look like men. Many angels look like men. So that because of this distinction, I don't think that, you know, Satan is a son of God. He's a serpent, a dragon-like. Adam was created in the image and likeness of God. It says specifically in Genesis chapter 1, verse 26, as are all of Adam's descendants, as it says in Genesis 5, verse 3. Christ, the second Adam, was the express image of the Father, in Hebrews chapter 1, verse 3. And Christ is a man, specifically stated in 1 Timothy verse 2 and verse chapter 2 and verse 5. Second, the sons of Elohim were present at creation. Later in the book of Job, Yahweh answers Job's questions, Job's demand for an explanation of. Job asks, "Well, why was I put through all of this?" And Job answered that question, or God answered Job's question. In response, God talks about the time of creation in Job chapter 38, verses 4 to 7. Where were you, Job, when I laid the foundations of the earth? Declare it if you have understanding. Who has laid the measures thereof, if you know? Who has stretched the line upon it, upon the earth? Whereupon was the foundation thereof fastened? Who laid the cornerstone thereof? When the morning stars, in other words, when this all took place, when the morning stars sang together, morning stars is another term for angels, and all the sons of Elohim shouted for joy. In other words, those sons of Elohim and the morning stars, the angels, as groups, as classes of beings, were present when God laid the foundation of the earth. So the phrase sons of God occurs three times in Job, and each of them designated divine beings with access to heaven, to the throne of God, which, of course, human beings cannot see God and live. God is invisible to us. And those beings, the sons of God, were present at the physical creation, at least of the earth, and they were created before the creation of man. This information was well known to the readers of Genesis chapter 6, verses 1 to 4. And third, the sons of Elohim are not human. Read again Genesis chapter 6, verses 1 to 4. The offspring of the sons of God and the daughters of men were giants, Nephilim in Hebrew, and gigantes in the Greek Old Testament. That's where the word giants comes from.
Now, what does Nephilim mean? Fallen ones?
It means fallen ones, or ones who are fallen, or it seems to mean that. It may mean something else, we're not quite sure, but indications indicate that it does mean fallen ones in some way. How that refers, why the sons would be referenced as fallen ones, it's unclear, and I don't quite have an answer to that question. But we do know that ordinary men mating with daughters, with ordinary women, with the daughters of men, do not produce giants.
Right.
At one time, of course, the idea is, well, the demons were able to manipulate the DNA. While that's perhaps possible, you know, that's not what the text says. The sons of God, who were apparently divine beings, according to Job, produced giants when they mated with the when they married and mated the daughters of men. And they were radically different. The whole concept of the passage in Genesis 6:4 is to show the contrast between the sons of God and the daughters of men. And that they were radically different from each other, and yet they could interbreed. Nobody knows how, except that it shows how similar the sons of God were to human beings. Furthermore, human beings don't have access to heaven and or to the throne of God, and the sons of Elohim definitely did. Another point is, at present, no human being has access to God's throne except the resurrected man, Jesus Christ. And all human beings who have ever died are still dead. Christ alone is the single human being who sits at the right hand of God the Father at this present moment. And he does not merely have access to the throne of God. He sits on his throne next to God the Father. And when we are there legally as Christians who have the Spirit of God, and when we are glorified, we shall be seated with Christ at the right hand of glory. And this is in Romans 1:17 and Ephesians 2:5 and 7 and Revelation chapter 3 verse 21. We, the ecclesia of God, are Christ's body. So not yet, but in the future, we will be in heaven and have access to the throne of God. In the fourth point relating to the sons of God is that the sons of Elohim married the daughters of men before and after the flood and this is mentioned in Genesis 6:4. Now, the whole passage of Genesis 6, verses 1 to 13, gives the reason for the flood. And it says, there were giants in those days, Nephilim in those days, meaning before the flood, and also after that. Apparently, somebody inserted this, it may have been Moses, this passage about, and also after that, may have been Moses or Samuel or Jeremiah, who knows, but it was a legitimate addition to the text. The phrase, and also after that, refers to the days after the flood, an editorial addition to the original text. And this indicates that the same type of matings and of sons of God with the daughters of men took place before and after the flood. It took place after the flood just like they did before the flood. And this is proven by the genealogies of the sons of Anak, who are the descendants of Anakim,
yes,
and the sons of Repha, the descendants of the Rephaim, all of whom arose after the flood. Anak and Repha were the most famous of the post-flood Nephilim, who are the offspring of the Genesis 6:4 matings. These descendants lived in Palestine when the people of Israel arrived to take over that land that God was going to give to them. It says in Numbers chapter 13, verses 32 and 33, and all the people that we saw in it, in the land, are men of great stature. And there we saw the giants. Once again, the Hebrew term Nephilim is used. There we saw the giants, the sons of Anak, which come from the giants, come from the Nephilim. And we were in our own sight as grasshoppers, and so we were in their sight. The word men in verse 32 of Numbers 13 is the word enosh, meaning a person or an individual with emphasis on their mortality. In other words, these giants could die, as we know that Goliath died. It is distinct from the term Adam or human. The usage of Enosh is consistent within the Old Testament to indicate mortals. In other words, these were not godlike beings in it by any sense. They were physical, they were mortal, they were just very, very big. And don't think for a minute that they weren't coordinated. Just not like giants today, which are very gangly, and these were big, strong, powerful, dangerous people. Dangerous giants. That's what made them so threatening to the Israelites, both when they came into Canaan and before the Israelite army in the time when David killed Goliath.
Weren't they also cannibals?
There's some indication. Most pagan religion, especially the Canaanites and in Tyre, the Phoenicians, did practice cannibalism as well. As this was all part of that. Particularly they probably ate the bodies of the giants when they were killed to partake of some of this. But as we now know, cannibalism breeds a particular form of insanity, which
yeah.
is what comes from when animals and humans eat their own kind.
Right.
When you eat your own kind, there's a particular brain disease that develops. And it affects most cannibalistic societies, as a matter of fact, and brings those societies down to a lower level very, very quickly.
I think it's called Kuru, something like that.
Could be. I don't remember the exact term. Another point is that Elohim, the sons of Elohim, are not angels. In Hebrews chapter 1, verse 5, it specifically says, "For unto which of the angels said he, God, at any time, you are my son, this day I have begotten you. And again, I will be to him a father, and he shall be to me a son." In other words, twice in one passage, the Apostle Paul, who I think wrote Hebrews, asks rhetorical questions in which the answer is in the negative. Which of the angels has he ever said, "You are my son"? And which of the angels has he ever said, "I will be to him a father, and he shall be to me a son"? The answer is no to both those questions. And Paul is making it as clear as he can that angels are not sons of Elohim. They are Elohim, but they are not ever called sons. So that the sons of Elohim back in Genesis 6, Job chapter 1 and chapter 2 and chapter 38 verse 7, and elsewhere, as we'll see in Scripture, are never called sons of God or sons in any way. The author of Hebrews poses these two questions, and he states them differently, but they both have the same answer. And the answer is that no angel can ever be considered a son. Now, this analysis, for some reason, I've never seen anyone analyze it like this, except Dr. Ernest Martin, and it just opened up this whole study, for me personally, regarding the sons of God. It solved a multitude of problems once you distinguish angels from the sons of God. His correct and obvious analysis of Hebrews chapter 1, like I said, is unique as far as I can tell. And you should look in his book, Essentials of New Testament Doctrine, which is on the website, chapter 28, Who Are the Sons of God? And this is online on the ASK website. Now, I believe that angels also had relations with human women, but those angels were not sons of God, and neither did the angels marry those women. They were the ones who the ancient pagan myths show of abducting women and raping them, like the Greek myth of Zeus and all that
stuff. I think even today we have a lot of reports of women being abducted,
right.
Impregnated. Then at 3 months, first trimester, the baby disappears. A lot of this is medically documented.
I believe those events take place.
Yeah.
And I've spoken with too many people who have experienced similar things, that they do occur.
Yeah.
And it's disastrous emotionally for the individuals who have this. Remember it said, Jesus said, in the days of Noah, there will be marrying and giving in marriage. Well, what kind of marriage was being talked about before the flood in Genesis 6? It was talking about the sons of God marrying the daughters of men. That's not...
You mentioned, too, David, that these entities are on earth today.
I believe some of them may be, either if not on earth, then around the earth.
Yeah, I kind of do, too.
And this is what composes a large number of the UFOs that we see. Some of them are good angels in craft or what we might call chariots or whatever.
Yeah.
Others are evil, and some of them are the sons of God. The creation is quite a bit more complex than the normal theological understanding of humans, God, and angels.
I agree.
And, you know, of course, this understanding of Hebrews chapter 1 does agree of this, regarding the sons of God being a valid class of beings does great violence to the Trinity concept.
Yes.
And I asked a nationally known Trinitarian expositor in 1997 about Hebrews chapter 1, and he said, oh no, that's just a discussion about Christ, doesn't have anything to do with the sons of God or the Nephilim.
Uh-huh.
And I don't see how you could avoid that conclusion, that it definitely refers to angels. Now, the book of Jude and the book of 2 Peter talk about angels specifically who left their habitation and committed some type of fornication.
Yeah.
And they were put in prison. And Peter talks about Christ speaking to those angels in prison. Now, these angels are not demons. These are angels. Because the demons are out and about, you know, involved with people. They're not in prison.
Yeah.
These angels are specifically ones who left their habitation and committed some type of fornication. Now, fornication is always sexual in the New Testament.
Right.
And they became involved with human women somehow. This is why the Apostle Paul said that in church, at least at that time, women should always have their head covered. I don't quite follow what Paul is referring to or what, but he does remark in regard to angels. So, you know, I have heard some strange goings-on in Pentecostal circles.
Maybe, you know, having their head covered, women, particularly in ancient times, had long hair.
Yes.
And that may have been what attracted them, was the long hair. I don't know.
Could be. But it doesn't take long to study charismatic occurrences.
Yeah.
That they bear very similar marks to sexual activity mm-hmm. on the part of the participants.
Right.
And people who come out of that tradition will acknowledge that on occasion. So it's not unheard of. The descriptions, and when you see it occur, very similar. And of course, people who were not sexually involved ordinarily would perhaps not even recognize the similarity. But some individuals I've talked to, there is more than a similarity. There's an identity. But, and actually, I don't want to go into detail of that. I want to stick with the subject regarding the sons of God. But this information in the book of Hebrews, in Hebrews chapter 1, should be considered authoritative, because Hebrews directly refutes. Hebrews chapter 1 and chapter 2 deal with angels. And Paul, in my view, wrote Hebrews chapter 1 and chapter 2 to directly address misunderstandings that his audience had with regard to angels. And in my view, it directly refutes commonly held first century beliefs that are stated in some of the apocryphal books such as the Book of Enoch and Jubilees. These beliefs were reported to us as being quite common, according to the Jewish historian Josephus and the Jewish philosopher Philo.
Yeah.
The common belief was at that time that angels were the sons of God. And the Hebrews chapter 1 specifically and distinctly refutes that belief and understanding. Jews today, if you read the commentaries, have two views regarding the sons of God. They're either angels or humans. And both are wrong. The sons of God are a separate class.
Yeah, I think so too. I mean, just
yeah.
Even before you and I ever talked, period, I just from my own studies, I came to that conclusion that they're different.
Yeah, well, you're way ahead of me that you were able to make that distinction. You know, you kind of wonder, it just didn't make sense. It didn't
yeah.
fit the human category, and it didn't fit the angelic category.
Right.
Even Bullinger, in his companion Bible, in his wonderful appendices, which are online,
mm-hmm.
You can read them, and there's just something that doesn't quite click in
yes.
that explanation of the sons of God as angels.
Exactly.
And the Greek in the book of Hebrews is recognized as the most sophisticated. It's almost the best Greek in not just the Bible, but in all of Greek literature. It's just amazing, according to some of the commentators, on how wonderful the Greek is in the book of Hebrews. The point is that it's so precise. There can be no ambiguity regarding this passage. And not only that, but there's no textual variance either. So it says what it says. And the Greek of Hebrews, the book of Hebrews, is not the common Greek of the fisherman or the Galilean, as was most of the writings of the apostles.
Right.
It is very sophisticated, written by a well-educated author, scholar, of the Hebrew Scriptures, written in the finest of Greek literary tradition. And not only that, but a lot of people think that the book of Hebrews reflects, and I may have even said this myself in the past, uses the Greek Septuagint. But in fact, it does not. It does in some cases. It corrects the Greek Septuagint quite a bit. And because the Greek of the book of Hebrews is more precise and corrects errors in the Greek Old Testament, and also corrects or updates, I wouldn't say corrects, but updates, and is more precise when it cites the Hebrew Scriptures. The Hebrew Scriptures are rarely wrong, whereas the Greek Old Testament is a translation, which the apostles used, and which the author of Hebrews uses, but he corrects it. Hebrews chapter 1 corrected misconceptions that the ecclesias had at the time concerning angels that came from the Greek translation of the book of Job in its references to the sons of God. In the Greek Old Testament, they are translated as angels of God in Job chapter 1, chapter 2, and in Job 38, verse 7. And this is an error, which was corrected by the author of Hebrews. This refutation by the author of Hebrews is strengthened by the fact that I've got it written here, and I need to correct it, because I've since learned that this is not the case, that I've written in this article, which I wrote not too many months ago, I write that the author of the book of Hebrews uses the Septuagint. Well, he does not. He corrects it. It was commonly held from the 2nd century BCE to the 1st century CE, current era, in other words, during the church, 2 centuries before the church and through the century of the church, including the Dead Sea Scrolls during that time and the composition of the New Testament, that it was angels who bred with women in Genesis chapter 6. And this is wrong. Flavius Josephus, the first century Pharisee and historian, Jewish historian, gives his understanding in Antiquities of the Jews, chapter 1, .73. For, quote, "For many angels consorted with women and begat sons who were overbearing and disdainful of every virtue. Such confidence had they in their strength, and in fact, the deeds that tradition ascribes to them resemble the audacious exploits told by the Greeks of the giants, the Titans." Now, although angelic matings with humans did occur, these matings were different and distinct from the matings between the sons of God and the daughters of men. If you keep these things separate, things tend to make a lot more sense when you look at the pagan traditions and myths. In my understanding, the matings of an offspring of angels and women were even more bizarre than the Nephilim, who at least were human-looking, totally. Whereas the offspring of the sons of the angels and women later on became identified with the sons of Elohim. This is because of the Dead Sea Scrolls and the Septuagint. In the Dead Sea Scrolls, the introduction to the Genesis Apocryphon, 1QAP Genesis, Column 2, there's a passage where the fictional Lamech, the father of Noah, quote, suspects that his wife has conceived a child by one of the fallen angels. And, you know, this is totally mistaken, and the book of Hebrews is correcting this information. So what you've got here, is a commonly held belief. In the first century, angels were still understood, as Josephus says, to be interacting with the Jews and other nations directly. And the sons of God, however, appear to have departed some 600 years earlier through death or exile. And some might be coming back as we approach the end time. Certainly the angels have always been here, the evil angels, mixing in with humans. Not mixing in necessarily, but some apparently have. And this will be explained in a future article. Another point is that the sons of Elohim are the gods of the nations. And now we come to the heart of the matter regarding the pagan gods. The sons of God were assigned to the various nations of the world for them to rule according to the allotment of those nations that God allotted to each of the sons of God. You're supposed to rule this nation. You've been assigned this nation and this nation and this nation. And they were to represent, their purpose was to represent Yahweh to those nations. And they failed horribly, disgustingly, in fact. The King James Version reads as follows in Deuteronomy 32, verses 8 and 9, quote, when the Most High divided to the nations their inheritance, in other words, the Assyrians are to go here, the Egyptians are to go here, when he divided the nations to their inheritance, when he separated the sons of Adam, he set the bounds of the people according to the number of the sons of Israel, for the Lord's portion, Yahweh's portion, is his people, and Jacob is the lot of his inheritance. So, according to the King James Version, Yahweh allotted the nations according to the number of the children of Israel, but this doesn't make any sense. If the bounds of the nations were indeed set according to the number of the sons of Israel, what number of the children of Israel is being referred to? Was it Jacob's 12 sons? No, because there were more than 12 nations. There were 70 or sometimes 72, depending on how you count them. in Genesis chapters 10 and 11, there's a table of nations which lists the nations at the time of Genesis, when the nations were separated. Was this referring to the number of Israelites who went into Egypt at the time of Jacob? Well, this is possible, because both that number and the number of nations do seem to correspond. But the text doesn't say that precisely at all, actually. There were 70 members of Jacob's household in Egypt during the time of Joseph. This is said in Exodus chapter 1, verses 1 to 5. The problem is that except for the number 70, there's no relationship at all to the division of the nations. It just doesn't correspond. Okay, so what? What does this mean? That occurred, you know, the division of the nations occurred some 200 years before Abraham. Israel didn't even exist when this division of the nations occurred. So what is Genesis passage of referring to, or the Deuteronomy 32 passage of referring to? God, quote, separated the sons of Adam, end quote, at the time of Babel, in the confusion of languages. The separation of the nations had apparently no relationship to the number of the children of Israel, so that there's a textual problem here. And after the flood, the division of nations occurred during the time of Peleg. In Genesis chapter 25, chapter 10, verse 25, it says, quote, "And unto Eber were born two sons. The name of one was Peleg, for in his days was the earth, the eretz, the land, the ground, divided." And then in verse 32 of Genesis chapter 10, it says, "These are the nations of the sons of Noah after their generations. In their nations, and by these were the nations divided in the earth after the flood," end quote. So the name Peleg in Hebrew means division, or it is divided. In other words, during the time life of Peleg, a specific event occurred that caused a scattering of the peoples, and there weren't very many at that time. As it says in Genesis chapter 11, verses 1 to 9. Now, specifically, verse 9 says, quote, "Therefore is the name of it called Babel, because the Lord," or Yahweh, "did there," at Babel, "confound the language of all the earth, and from thence," in other words, from Babel, "did the Lord Yahweh scatter them abroad upon the face of the earth." At the time of Babel, God scattered the nations, and as we know from Genesis 25, they were scattered during the time and the life of the son of Eber, who the Hebrews were named after, the son by the name of Peleg, which means divided. So that the confusion of languages took place at the same moment as the Babel event. When the nations and languages were divided and confused, the nations were then sent out. This was the time of the division of the earth. Now, this may refer to the also, because it talks about the land being moved. There might have actually been a physical movement of the landmass itself, as well as the division and migration of peoples. Can't tell exactly from the text. But the scattering of the nations apparently occurred over the entire period of Peleg's lifetime. This is in Genesis chapter 10, verse 25, and comparing that with 1 Chronicles chapter 1, verse 18. When the Apostle Paul spoke to the idolatrous Greek Gentiles in Athens, in Acts chapter 17, verses 25 to 27, he asserted that God puts the nations where he wants them to be at any particular time, both in the past and even at the time of Paul's present day. So that scattering is what is being referred to in Deuteronomy chapter 32, verse 8. But there is a problem in the Masoretic text of Deuteronomy 32:8 as reflected in the King James Version. This is well known to Old Testament textual scholars. And, there's a reference that I highly recommend you go to and follow up on this article. It's footnote number 29. But the phrase "sons of Israel" in the King James Version should actually be "sons of Elohim." And once this is understood and the change is made, then the passage literally explodes with meaning. Now I'm going to read it again as it properly is to be understood. Quote, "When the Most High divided to the nations their inheritance, and he separated the sons of Adam, he set the bounds of the people according to the number of the sons of Elohim. For the Lord's portion is his people, and Jacob is the lot of his inheritance." In other words, he divided the nations according to the sons of Elohim, the sons of God, but he kept Israel for his portion. And this all makes sense. These two verses give an important historical perspective. There were two classes of inheritance. One was the earlier division of the nations when the sons of God were, in other words, dealt out. Everyone gets a card. And that card is the nation which you are supposed to be the God of, to the sons of Elohim, of the nations. Then later, God created Israel, and he kept Israel as his nation, his portion, his people. The inheritance of the nations began at the time of Babel, during the lifetime of Peleg. The inheritance of Israel began with Jacob, in verse 32:9. Much later than the division of the nation, each inheritance had two parties that were involved. One was the subjects of the inheritance, which were the nations individually, and the other was the administrator of the inheritance. For the peoples of the nations, the sons of Adam were the subjects, each according to their borders. One son of Elohim was originally administered one person, one people or nation. The nation and the people of Israel were subject to Yahweh, and they were to be his allotment, his inheritance. Now, in other verses, it talks about, there's more information about God's inheritance. In Genesis 15, chapter 15, verses 18 to 21, God delineates the boundaries of Abraham's inheritance, which was later to be given to Abraham's grandson, Jacob. So there's actually quite a bit of literature on this, what's called the Divine Council, and that this is the reason that the sons of God were brought before God in Job chapter 1 and chapter 2. They were giving reports on what they had done during the time period, at least the ones that were, still doing what they were doing. The Hebrew Masoretic text of verse 8 of Deuteronomy chapter 2 has "sons of Israel" in the King James Version, whereas it should be "sons of Elohim" as indicated above. Now, the Septuagint, the Greek Old Testament, and Symmachus, Greek translation, they both have "angels of God" in verse 8 instead of "children of Israel," while the Hebrew of the Dead Sea Scrolls has, quote, "sons of Elohim," which is a much more meaningful rendering. In the notes for Deuteronomy 32, verse 8, the authoritative Biblia Hebraica Stuttgartensia indicates that the most likely correct rendering is either "sons of Elim" or "sons of Elohim." So that what we have here, and we perhaps should break this up soon, is that Deuteronomy chapter 4, verses 19 to 20, directly parallels chapter 32, verses 8 and 9 in several ways. In Deuteronomy 4, verses 19 and 20, the hosts of heaven correspond to the sons of Elohim in Deuteronomy 32, 8 and 9. The hosts of heaven are portioned out to the nations. Then Yahweh tells how he took Israel as his inheritance. The division of the nations directly relates to the hosts of heaven, not to Israel. In Deuteronomy 32, verses 8 and 9, the nations are divided, quote, according to the number of the sons of Elohim. And again, Yahweh takes Israel as his inheritance. This alone rules out sons of Israel as the correct rendering for Deuteronomy 32, verse 8 and 9. Furthermore, Israel certainly is in no position, either in the past or in the present, to administer the inheritance in the nations of the nations at the time of Moses. And Deuteronomy 32, 8, and 9 looks to the past. It is not a prophecy. The incoherence of the translation sons of Israel with the context of 32, 8 and chapter 32, verses 8 and 9, and the entire Song of Moses of chapter 32, along with the important textual problems, all demand sons of Elohim to be the correct rendering. And there's an internal symmetry and parallel in Deuteronomy chapter 32, 8 and 9. And when it's set out this way, as it is, as you could see it in the text, you have the nation's inheritance with the setting of the boundaries, which are ruled by the sons of Elohim as Yahweh's proxies. Then you have Jacob's inheritance with the boundaries set, ruled by Yahweh directly. The boundaries of Jacob were those designated to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and reiterated by Moses. And that Israel was to inherit when it took possession of the land from the Canaanites. Now, in the future, Israel will have power and control over the nations to a certain extent, but certainly not in the past, and they neither had the power or the authority or the wisdom to have any relationship to the nations at all. In fact, they were commanded by God to avoid the nations. So, but each son of Elohim was assigned to be the God or El over a particular nation or a people. The inheritance of the nations was to be administered by the sons of Elohim, and it was intended for the sons of Elohim and to rule and to judge the nations with justice. And this is according to Psalm 82, a wonderful psalm that is 8 verses long, and it shows the judgment upon the sons of Elohim when they failed to rule correctly. The inheritance of Jacob, Israel, was kept by Yahweh for himself as the chief El. Yahweh created Israel from Abraham, began it with his blessing to Abraham, which was Jacob's grandfather. Deuteronomy 32, verses 8 and 9, contrasts the situation of the nations with Israel's situation under Yahweh. These two verses are contained within the larger context of what is called the Song of Moses in Deuteronomy chapter 32, verses 1 to 43, which is Moses' final restatement of the history and the covenant between Israel and Yahweh given just before Moses' death. According to Deuteronomy 32, verses 8 and 9, God did four things during the time of Peleg, when the nations had their inheritance. First, the Most High divided to the nations their inheritance of land. He separated the sons of Adam. He set the bounds of their habitation, and he did this according to the number of the sons of Elohim. Each of the nations were allotted one of the sons of Elohim, who were tasked to watch over, to judge, and presumably teach the nations about God. Later, Yahweh created and separated Israel out of the nations as the portion of, as he says, quote, his inheritance. Another interesting passage is Deuteronomy chapter 29, verses 25 to 26. And there's no textual problem here. But it says, quote, then men shall say, because they forsook the covenant of Yahweh, the Elohi of their fathers. Elohi is a plural term of El. They forsook the covenant of Yahweh and the Elohim of their fathers, which he made with them when he brought them forth out of Egypt, and they, Israel, went and served other Elohim, and they worshipped them, Elohim that they knew not, and Elohim that he had not allotted to them. Once again, a reference to the allotment. In other words, when Israel went after other gods, they went after gods that were not allotted to them. Yahweh was their allotment for Israel, and there was severe punishment. The term allotted in Hebrew has the sense of meaning of something that was given or divided unto you. Deuteronomy 29, verses 25 and 26. You could view this as stating that the distributions of the nations to the sons of God was literally conducted by lottery. And this would be similar to the lottery of our personal inheritance, our birth order, and placement. In other words, we were born here and now rather than in the time of Moses. That God actually says that we were allotted for our salvation. And this is the biblical explanation of the lottery. You can read about this in chapter 25, How Were We Chosen, in Dr. Martin's book, The Essentials of New Testament Doctrine. That's also on the ASK website. So God allotted the gods, the sons of Elohim, to the nations and vice versa. And after all, Yahweh allotted the various Elohim to the nations who worshiped those Elohim. It was allowable and permissible for those nations, those peoples, to worship their God that Yahweh had allotted to them. They did no sin by doing so, because God gave them to them. However, when they encounter Israel, it was forbidden for the nations to deal with Israel and to try to corrupt Israel with their gods, and it was forbidden for Israel to relate to the pagan gods. Yahweh, as the chief Elohim, reserved Israel for himself. Yahweh was the Elohim of Israel and the only allowable Elohim of Israel, even though other gods existed. The gods of the nations were the sons of Elohim, the Benai HaElohim, which other nations could worship with Yahweh's permission, but they were to stay away from Israel, and those gods were allotted to the nations, and they were not allotted to Israel. The Shema, spoken by Moses, is the basic statement of faith by believing Jews today. And this is in Deuteronomy chapter 6, verses 4 and 5. And with this understanding, the Shema makes better sense than it ever will before. Hear, O Israel, quote, hear, O Israel, Yahweh, our Elohim, is one Yahweh. And you, meaning Israel, shall love Yahweh, your Elohim, with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your might. That's the Shema that every observant Jew prays every single day. But it's talking about Yahweh is the Elohim of Israel. Does not deny that there are other Elohim and that Yahweh is singular. He is the one God. He is the creator. This passage alone demands the conclusion that there were other Elohim than Yahweh. Yahweh assigned the Elohim of the nations to them. Israel was a special creation by Yahweh who kept Israel to himself as Yahweh's purpose was to always have Israel as a witness for him to other nations as an example, and for them to then also, for Israel to compare, for Israel and the nations to compare Yahweh to the other gods. The other gods were unfaithful in their leadership of the nations as their God. And Israel was unfaithful, and the nations were unfaithful to their gods. They whored after other gods of other nations also. Israel was unfaithful to Yahweh, and they whored after the other pagan gods. But Yahweh was always faithful to Israel. See how this all plays out. It's very precise. Yahweh was the God of Israel and the God of the Hebrews. So too, the Old Testament identifies some of the gods of the nearby nations. The Elohim of Syria were Baal and Ashtaroth. The Elohim of the Canaanites was, one of them was Baal. The Elohim of the Philistines was Dagon and Baal-Berith.
What about Persia?
Well, you've got Marduk and Ishtar, and which are made fun of in the Book of Esther. Esther is an offtake, is an offshoot, an offtake of Ishtar. And Mordecai, her Esther's uncle, is an offtake of Marduk. And there's an interplay of, through the Esther story, of God making fun of the Persian gods, Ishtar and Marduk. And I don't think the definitive study has ever been done on the myths of Persia and its relationship to the Book of Esther. Now, I'm not saying by any means that the Book of Esther is derived from those myths, just the opposite. The Book of Esther is putting down the gods of Persia through the telling of this story. Likewise, the Exodus specifically states that the plagues that were put upon Egypt were a show of the impotence of the gods of Egypt,
right,
compared to Yahweh. And this is exactly what's going on in the Book of Esther with Ishtar and Marduk and Esther and Mordecai. It shows the impotence of the gods of Persia and yet God is operating in the background,
you know,
to save Israel.
Yeah, and it's real interesting too, because in the Gospels, David, Jesus says that his mission is, you know, to the lost sheep of Israel.
Exactly.
Very interesting, you know. And it goes together like hand in glove.
Yeah.
You know, it's amazing. And people that lived hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years apart, who did not have access to their predecessors' material, came up with the things they did. I mean, truly inspired by God.
Well, there's a an article that we should do that Dr. Martin wrote in the 1980s, which I updated and annotated. Can't think of the name right now, and I don't want to go search for it. But it shows how all the ancient stories, when Nebuchadnezzar conquered all the nations of the world, or forced them to submit to his sovereignty, he collected all the books and all the libraries of all the nations and had them taken to Babylon. And the keeper of those books was the chief of the Magi, who was Daniel. And this is why the books of the Bible, the Old Testament, before the time of Daniel, survived. Because Daniel was in charge of the library, you might say. Now, all these ancient books of the pagan countries were largely destroyed when Nebuchadnezzar and, you know, Babylon was destroyed. Now, maybe those books are still in, you know, when Iraq gets back into shape and becomes a worthwhile nation of the world, maybe that library will be discovered someday. We'll see. I think it's more likely that the tomb of David would be discovered and that the Bible then will become the standard. But Nebuchadnezzar wanted a one-world government, and he wanted his story to be the one that was his story of creation and his rule and his mindset to teach all the children of the world. Remember, he brought all the sharp, noble children to Babylon, and Meshach, Shadrach, and Abednego, as well as Daniel, were part of the ones from Israel that were brought to Babylon to be taught, to be the intelligentsia. They were the geniuses of their societies, to be taught the new world order of Babylon. And that world order still exists today in the commercial structure of all the nations of the world, of which the United States is the leading proponent. Although China and India are challenging the United States, and in 50 years they may overtake the United States in economic power. That being said, at present, that Babylonian system still exists and is still in force and in power. And but the histories of the ancient times, they were all cataloged, they kept all good records, but they were all destroyed when, you know, over the generations, when Babylon declined. Babylon did not collapse or wasn't destroyed. It kind of petered away. So there's a chance that those books might still be extant unless the Persians took them over. But it was Daniel who protected and preserved the writings of the Bible, the Old Testament, before the exile, which then Ezra and Nehemiah took back to Israel at the time the exile ended, after the 70 years exile. So it's a complete story. And, you know, I think we should break now when we'll get into what the scripture says that the other nations were actually doing, what the other gods, the pagan gods were actually doing before the exile. Now, at the time of the exile of Judah and the time of Jeremiah, not only were the nations, many of the nations destroyed and new nations were brought up, but the gods, the old gods went away, and the sons of God were put into either exile or killed, literally killed, many of them,
right,
of the 70 or however many there were. And we'll get into this at a later time, but this program's getting a little long, so
yeah,
we should
break off.
It's
a fascinating study, and I think it's very pertinent.
Right, and the Bible is the key
to
all these myths in ancient history, and the current day, and the near future as we approach the second coming.
That's right.
And all this stuff will relate and dovetail to the future, because as in the days of Noah, so shall it be at the coming of the Son of Man.
Amen. That's true. Oh, God bless you, David, for the work you've put into this, and bless all the listeners out there. This is very important information.
You won't find it anywhere else either.
Well, you can say that again. It is important, because we are beginning to witness a lot of very strange things in the last couple of decades, and it's going to intensify as the time draws nearer. Everybody, go to Ask Elm, AskElm.com. There are many good articles and books for free that you can read online. There are also audio files there. And David Seeloff has put in an extraordinary amount of time and energy with his work. And I just appreciate it so very much. So we will be back, it looks like, with part three of Idolatry and the Sons of God. This will end part two. This is Georgianne Hughes with David Seeloff signing off. God bless everyone out there listening, and God bless you too, David. Good night, everybody.